This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
My name is Andy, and I'm a resident here. And this morning, I would like to talk about patience. It's something that doesn't come very easy for me, so it's a very rich topic. And every time I explore a topic for the few talks that I've given, I feel like I only begin or scratch the surface of it or begin an exploration. And that's what this topic feels like too, and I really hope that we have some time for a little bit of question and answer or discussion really on this so that we can apply it to our practice. Together. So, patience is one of the paramitas, or the six perfections. And the paramitas are generosity, dana, discipline, sila, patience, kshanti, perseverance, virya, also, meditation, dhyana, and wisdom, prajna. These are the Sanskrit terms I'm saying with each one. And as one of the paramitas, it's emphasized not only here in this teaching, in this unfoldment, or this angle of the Dharma, of the paramitas, or the six perfections, but it's also considered... You could look at it or consider it as almost fundamental or very important to the Dharma as a whole or the practice as a whole, and that's in the way that I'm exploring it. So, naturally, I looked up patience, which is what we often do when we're presenting a concept. We look at the definition. And what does a dictionary definition say? Well, this is the Google dictionary definition. I liked what it said. It said, the capacity to accept or tolerate delay, trouble, or suffering without getting angry or upset. Which I find very interesting. The capacity to accept or tolerate delay, trouble, suffering, without getting angry or upset. Furthermore, if you look up patience from a psychological perspective, I found tolerance of provocation without responding in annoyance or anger, forbearance when under strain, especially when faced with longer-term difficulties. So, exploring what that means, we're kind of unpacking this Sanskrit term of kshanti, and we're trying to understand what that is. And oftentimes when we're translating from one language, especially an ancient language like Sanskrit, it takes many words for us to kind of understand, what is it pointing to? What is it pointing at? And so when it starts to open up a little bit into tolerance, that's a little bit of a different idea. Also, words that were mentioned in here are forbearance. You start getting into endurance. And that starts to relate to, for me, training. It's just like a lot like physical training. In the sports that I played when I was younger, we would train the body. And also, it was a mental game, too. You'd train the mind. To be able to accommodate different situations. And it doesn't mean that you could train for every situation that you were going to face on the field. But you could train in general preparation to accommodate a lot of different situations. You could train your body. You could know the plays. You could do a fair amount of preparation. And it did matter. And so from that perspective, can we actually train in patience? Can we train to tolerate and notice when we're responding in annoyance and anger? So that's really the question that I've been holding, and as I've been preparing for this, I've been using it much like a teacher of mine asked me to explore the koan of mu, which I have totally failed and not passed completely. I think I mentioned that months ago, and Rebecca was here to give a talk on koan study, and it's wonderful. In the failure, it's been a great failure, because it was a lot of exploration of it. And part of the instruction was, all through the day, ask, what is mu? What is mu? Where is mu? What is mu? So I'd ask all through the day. And I'm like, I don't even know what the heck this means. And so I go to him with some, like, it means this. And it's like, or I can't conceive of it. And so therefore, it's everywhere. And he's like, no, you know. Or he'd make a little vomiting sound or something. And I love that process, actually. I love the rejection in that process. But this is interesting, because asking, where is patience? What is patience? For the last couple weeks, especially this last week. So I'm getting a burrito, and they're making it in front of me, but they're out of a couple of ingredients. Or they've changed the ingredients. Where is patience? What is patience? What is impatience is a question. What is impatience? Is it wanting something to be different than it is? Wanting a different result? Expecting something? Feeling entitled to something? That seems to be kind of the opposite in some of the Buddhist teaching, especially with the Brahmaviharas or the Divine Abodes, or however you want to say it. We talk about a near enemy and far enemy. So for like compassion, a near enemy would be pity. And then a far enemy would be hatred. So I'm thinking of like, what would the near enemy and far enemy of patience be? So this kind of agitation, this kind of, I want it to be different, I want it now. Or you can even say aggression, because a lot of times some of the definitions of aggression, especially within the Dharma, are wanting something to be different than it is. I don't like that. Or wanting to get rid of it, wanting to push it away. You can't accommodate that. You don't have the forbearance. You don't have the tolerance for that, or rejection of something. So rather than accommodation. So that's where I've been finding the synonyms and kind of looking at this. Well, what is it really pointing at? What is Kshanti pointing at? What's being signified there? And so say I'm getting a burrito, and maybe the antidote, which we often talk about antidotes too when we have difficulty on the path, maybe the antidote is being grateful that I'm about to eat. There are a lot of people who don't have food, and I'm about to eat. So there's something that I can be grateful for in each moment. Like, gosh, those beans smell good, you know, or that person greeted me with a smile. And so there's more happening in the situation rather than just what I want and what I want now, especially when you're hungry. So there's that example for me. There's also, I've been thinking about, there seems to be some places in our lives where we're more patient than others, and in other areas in our lives where we're not very patient. And why? My girlfriend just told me the other day, she just said, you know, I'm so sorry you've been so patient with me these last couple of days. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I love you. It's been great. You know, and so I'm thinking, like, well, maybe I'm getting more patient. Maybe this is good. And then on the phone yesterday, after I got home from spending a few days with her, she said, she started to say something, and I thought I knew what she was saying, so I just cut right in and said, oh no, it's okay. You know, that's all. That's taken care of, and I don't think that, you know, I need to do that. And she goes, you know what? If you just listen to me sometimes, you might not know what I'm going to say. And she said, it's happened several times, especially the last few days, but I haven't said anything. So this whole idea that I'm getting better and more patient as I contemplate patience was just fell flat, right flat on its face. Because it looks like in some ways, patience can grow. So we are patient, and in other ways, we're not. And that's where I think that we rely on the reflection of Sangha, which takes many forms and many times takes the form of our intimate partner. So I found that quite humbling in a wonderful way. And so my response was, I just laughed. It was a deep belly laugh. She thought I'd be upset when she said that, but I was not. I thought that was perfect, and I was really glad that she spoke her mind. I love that about her. So in thinking of this, what is patience, tolerance? What is the near enemy of it, and what is the far enemy of it? I kept kind of going with that. And, you know, the texts say a lot of things, and I'll reference a few texts and a couple of quotes that were helpful in my exploration here from a couple of teachers and things. But what I drew on was I drew on dictionary definitions. I drew on those texts, my reflection during the week, and then also a particular book that I keep coming back to. This is by Robert Augustus Masters, and it's called Spiritual Bypassing. And I gave a talk on that a couple of years ago, but I keep returning to it because I think it helps us identify some of the near enemies of patience or kshanti or the perfection of tolerance and accommodation. Because it talks about the term spiritual bypassing was coined by John Wellwood in, I think, the 1970s. He was a psychologist who has a lot of great books on psychology and spirituality. And Augustus Masters wrote a book, titled this. And the first chapter, you don't have to go any further in the first pages of the book. It's called Avoidance in Holy Drag, an Introduction to Spiritual Bypassing. And he says that it's the use of spiritual practices and beliefs to avoid dealing with our painful feelings, unresolved wounds, and developmental needs is much more common than we might think, and in fact so pervasive to go largely unnoticed except in the more obvious extremes. And some of the list of it, he said, some of the ways that it can manifest are, we're using our spiritual practice basically to kind of shape or avoid things to our preferences. And oftentimes unconsciously, I would say some of these are near enemies to patience. Exaggerated detachment. Almost like rather than being unattached, being really separated from. Exaggerated detachment, emotional numbing and repression, overemphasis on the positive, anger phobia, as he calls it, blind, overly tolerant compassion, which that kind of highlights it as a near enemy for me to patience or accommodating or tolerance. Weak or too porous of boundaries. And I would add to that like a refusal of personal needs and inaction and or lack of clear action or appropriate response. So maybe we miss the mark sometimes. Maybe we try really hard to be patient. Maybe we try hard to be a good spiritual practitioner, a good Zen practitioner, a good Buddhist. And there are some subtle ways where this pursuit of perfection is imperfect. And I think it's useful to contemplate. And of course, the far enemy, the total opposite, I list it out as aggression, fear, anger, strong opinions, premature judgment, rushing to get to one place or another, not willing to see what's here, and even arrogance. There was a teacher when I was younger who I met with face to face, and he looked at me and he goes, "You have a lot of arrogance to cut through." And I just went, and they started saying something else. I went, "Hold up, can you back up to when you told me I have a lot of arrogance to cut through?" And he goes, "Oh, don't get hung up on it." you know, I'm like a 24-year-old and this is in college. He goes, don't get hung up on it. He said, your arrogance comes from when you think you know something. And he said, I'll say it again. Your arrogance comes from when you think you know something. So what's the antidote to the far enemy of patience? It looks like sometimes perhaps it's not knowing. Or to arrogance, to filling in the gaps. We think we know what's going on. We think we know what we want. Things aren't happening in the way we want them to. Maybe not knowing, but there's a difference between not knowing and becoming exaggeratedly detached or blind and embracing not knowing, embracing ambiguity. And actually just being right here with what's happening. Because it seems like that's what this text in on spiritual bypassing is pointing out, is we have all these inventive ways that we're not being right here. And we do it all the time, and it's helpful actually to have Sangha to reflect to us. It's helpful to me. It's helpful to have friends that aren't afraid to walk up to you and say, hey, you know, this, when you said this really didn't work, or this is going on, I'm noticing this. And then it may sting, but it may be actually the compassionate thing to receive, but also to offer in the right way at the right time and hopefully skillfully, which we're all learning constantly. It's a perfection that we'll never be perfect at, it seems. It's a pursuit of doing it in the moment and what's appropriate. So this whole working with what we have, the teacher, Charlotte Joko Beck, I found her to be a really quite wonderful teacher and could be very quite clear and direct at times too, and I love that about her. She says that life always gives us exactly the teacher we need at every moment. This includes every moment. This includes every mosquito, every misfortune, every red light, every traffic jam, every obnoxious supervisor or employee, every illness, every loss, every movement of joy or depression, every addiction, every piece of garbage, every breath, every moment is the guru. And that's not easy. It's an idea, but once we're sitting, once we're on the cushion, you know, what is it like? That's the question. So, another approach to this, which I find is interesting in shedding a light on patience, is a teacher who just died a couple weeks ago, Bernie Glassman, who was very instructive and helpful for me when I first started on the path. And he had, circles back to not knowing. He wrote a book called Bearing Witness, and he emphasized not knowing and bearing witness. And his third, there are two of three aspects to practice, not knowing, bearing witness. And then he first called it healing, and then he talked about it as loving action over time. It might be seen as like an appropriate response. So his approach to not knowing is interesting. But it's also, with this whole aspect of patience, is working with what we have rather than what we think we should have, or wanting things to be different than what they are. And in this book, it's called Instructions to the Cook. It's about Dogen's Instructions to the Tenzo. Instructions to the Cook is a book by Dogen. This is commentaries on it. And there's a quote in here that really emphasizes his main point that I feel is in this book. And he he would say this in his talks around that time too. He says, because of our attachments and our conditioning, we miss the food and drink that's right in front of us. In fact, the ingredients we need to make a meal that will satisfy us are all right here, but we refuse to accept the food that's offered. We get taken over by a feeling that we can't do what needs to be done. So we're always looking for something we don't have. Somehow we can't just say, let's take all this and make a wonderful feast. It all comes down to a very human habit. We're always looking for something beyond what is right in front of us. What I find interesting about that is that this almost rejection of the moment, this rejection of what's right here, is the metaphor of cooking in the kitchen. You know, what do we have? Are we endeavoring to use different ingredients or change something, or are we just letting it cook? Are we letting what we have, what we've already put in the pot, what's already in the pot, are we just letting it cook? And what if we do that? And why don't we do that? I think oftentimes it's that, why do we want things to be different? Sometimes we're afraid. We don't trust that what is right here is enough. And can we trust what is right here is enough? And what are we overlooking when we don't have that faith, we don't have that trust? Has anybody ever really tried hard to make something different than it is, or to change somebody, or to really change something that you don't like in yourself? What happens? Do you succeed?
Rarely.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes we can set goals and achieve goals, and it feels good, you know. But when we achieve the goals, does it feel like, or does it take the shape that we usually expected it to take? It's usually a little different. I used to work in fitness, and I noticed that some of my feelings about myself, no matter what fitness level I was at, they didn't go away. I was just at a different fitness level with those feelings about myself. And I was helping other people get fit, you know, and knowing that that's not going to solve all their problems. but it was still a great job. I loved doing it. It was satisfying. It was fun for a while. And then at a certain point, I wanted to focus on something else. But it's a part of my life. I enjoy it. I enjoy the physical activity. But at the same time, the setting of goals, the goals are empty. You know? And so I see that I keep going back to physical training or, you know, athletic training, but I guess we kind of go back to some of what we know. But it's like this is a bit like that too. We don't know. We don't know what we're stepping into fully. And oftentimes we fear the unknown, obviously. And so in my kind of exploration of this, I rediscovered something called the law of reversed effort, or the backwards law. And Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts, those are two guys that I couldn't stop reading, especially in my 20s. So I always like to go back to them. I feel like I'm kind of returning back to a baseline when I go back to Huxley and Watts. So the idea is that with our conscious will, we apply it to try to achieve a result and to try to get something done. You know, we can do it a lot. Like I said, look at the world around us. It's often comes about by mentally thinking of something and then doing what needs to be done to achieve a kind of result. And we have amazing technology and infrastructure and things like that. But does that always work on the inward level is the thing. Does this translate to introspective practice? So we have a conscious effort and hopes of increasing results. We're used to this working in some ways. It's not always how we expect, like we said. But at a certain point, we run into diminishing returns, and more effort does not necessarily equal better results. And Huxley says, the harder we try with a conscious will to do something, the less we shall succeed. Proficiency and the results of proficiency come only to those who have learned the paradoxical art of doing and not doing, or combining relaxation with activity, of letting go as a person in order that the imminent and transcendent unknown quality may take hold. We cannot make ourselves understand. The most we can do is to foster a state of mind in which understanding may come to us. We cannot make ourselves understand. The most we can do is foster a state of mind in which understanding may come to us. It reminds me of growing things. I'm not the world's most dedicated or best gardener by any means, but some people have. Mike works on the garden here quite a bit, as well as other people. And you can't make something grow. You can't force it. You can't just go, oh, grow faster. Grow like this. We want to do that, but we can't. We can prepare the ground. We can prepare the environment. We can let it get sunshine. We can water it. And it's said like that with Buddhism too. There is aspiring and entering are two qualities that's often talked about with compassion. You aspire and there's you enter. And one does not always necessarily lead to another in a very neat trajectory or a very neat linear sort of way. We have our aspirations, we take our intentions, and then we enter the path. And we don't always know what we're entering. We don't really know what we're entering, so not knowing. Dogen said, not knowing is most intimate. It's most intimate. I've been returning to that recently, especially when I think I know something, which usually points the way that I'm being arrogant. So Alan Watts, so we have what Aldous Huxley said and what Alan Watts said is that muddy water is best cleared by leaving it alone. Muddy water is best cleared by leaving it alone. So how does that translate to sitting on the cushion? What if we're just there? What if we keep showing up with this dynamism of being upright yet relaxed? I think that shows up in the paradoxical art of doing and not doing that Huxley says. Letting go. Combining relaxation with activity. Fostering a state of mind in which understanding may come to us. So I'm seeing this in Zazen. On the level of the body, on the level of our emotions, on the level of our thoughts. How do we let the mud settle? You know, in our chants during Sesshin, especially during our meal chants, we say maybe we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Even if the water is muddy, even if it's choppy, do we need to rush to change it? Or do we not meddle with it? Do we not take things for granted? Do we lean into it? Do we just, but not too much, do we just remain upright, regardless of what's happening, with a kind of composure? And the composure was a synonym to patience here. Another way to talk about it is admirable constancy. And constancy is apparently a term that Suzuki Roshi liked a lot. He liked that almost better than patience for us looking at this. Constancy meaning enduring, unchanging, faithful, and dependable. So is there something in our stillness something in the way that we approach or take the intent of being upright and still with whatever is happening. Is that a part of our patience? Is that a part of cultivating it? Is that a part of witnessing it, bearing witness to it? Is that a part of planting the seeds and just letting them grow? And it's brave work. It's scary sometimes. There's a lot that we don't know. We don't know about ourselves. The last quote that I have is by the poet Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke. And he, most people have heard this quote before. Everyone likes to quote Letters to a Young Poet, including me. I love that book. And I think this relates to knowing and not knowing. Why do you want to shut out your life? Any uneasiness, any misery, any depression, since after all, you don't know what work these conditions are doing inside you. We have the arrogance to think that we know what something means when it arises. And we have assumptions about it. And we're impatient about it. And we want it to be different. Maybe we should take a look at that. That's all I'm saying. You know, can we take a look at that? How do we take a look at that? I feel that we have some tools here in Zen. I hope that my reflection is helpful in some small way with your own reflective practice and our the practice that we do here together. I lied, I have one more quote. It's a poem by Matsuo Basho. The man picking radishes pointed the way with a radish. That goes back to cooking. It's my favorite haiku. I read it aloud to Craig Sakamoto, one of our, when I found it earlier this year in the kitchen, one of our residents here, and he just laughed. And every time I saw him for the next 2 or 3 weeks, we just laughed together about this haiku. The man picking radishes pointed the way with a radish. It's what he had. I don't know. You could look at that so many ways. I think we have time for questions, comments, concerns, corrections. Anybody? Everyone's welcome to join the discussion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you for that. That was great. The first thing that comes up to me, which I think you kind of addressed, but I'd like to ask you to go deeper into your thoughts on it.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that comes up is when we're really equanimous to events, and we do cultivate this type of tolerance, and we're very sincere about not trying to use it to bypass, but really just accepting and working through things.
Mm-hmm.
What then do you think guides us in making decisions or taking actions? Because typically, we make decisions, from my experience, it seems like most of us are making decisions and taking actions based on what to avoid things that we do not want and to go towards things that we do want, and that kind of undermines the foundation of that decision making.
Mm.
So that's my question.
Thank you. I'm going to receive that question for a couple of years. I'm serious. You know what you remind me of is I was talking to a friend of mine maybe 6 years ago, and he's a really good friend of mine, and we're talking about relationships, and he goes, Andy, he said, I really appreciate how much you're willing to put up with in relationship, because it's much more than what I would ever put up with, because I was telling him about a previous relationship. He goes, I really think that something that was passed to me could really help you out. He said, it's basically, you make three columns. And he goes, you identify your wants in relationship, your needs, and then separate the wants from the needs, and then your deal breakers. Exactly. And this, and you know what? It was actually helpful. I did it. And I really thought about it. And I did it for a while. And it helped me really with, you know, moving into next relationships in a way. But so there's that kind of conventional approach. I would say, you know, we can look at it as a conventional approach, how we look at things from a relative and conventional standpoint. And that, you know, it's not that that doesn't have its wisdom and applicability. What you're talking about, though, is kind of facing something perhaps with some equanimity, or maybe we can even say the joining of not knowing, or maybe some spaciousness from our habits, habitual energy, even our cultural habitual energy, or momentum of how we address things, including things like decisions or assessing a situation or measuring something, you know. Mike and I have had many conversations about, you know, anger too, about being measuring something against another, you know, or looking at it in such a extremely relative way, like only relative, where we favor it above all else. You know, that's it. You know, and we're lost. we're completely engorged and engaged in just that view. And if we are, well, what are some of the problems of that, you know, of our conditioning, of just being a conditioned being, you know? I look at it sometimes as being a spectrum. Maybe we're 20% conditioned and we've been practicing a lot and we're kind of equanimous, you know? Maybe we're 80% conditioned and, you know, we're spinning out, you know? We're uncomfortable. We're going back to what we're used to. We're regressing or something. That's the way I like to think about it. And I don't know if I have a quick answer. I'm curious what other people might say in the room. But I think a willingness to look, a willingness to see what's there, a willingness to not know, and also join the knowing and our preferences and our knee-jerk reactions with curiosity, spaciousness, tenderness, feeling into it. Because sometimes I think you don't necessarily know, but you just have a feeling. And some feelings we don't trust because we recognize them as pernicious emotions and other things that we label and make lists as in Buddhism. But some Buddhist teachers, like Angie will mention this quite a bit, that we need to trust ourselves sometimes. And do we want to overprivilege our cognitive relativistic read on it? Or, do we want to overprivilege that? Is that lopsided?
Well, I guess, because I've done this is my experience. Mm. When I try to step away from cognitive decision-making as the primary basis, and you're trying to trust these intuitive feelings that guide you, it includes conditioning. Those feelings include your conditioned emotional responses. Mm. They include things that I've absorbed from my family that I didn't even experience. Mm. That I'm very triggered by things that my parents and grandparents experienced.
Mm.
I'm frightened of that because I can see that it's not real. So to surrender to this intuitive guidance, it seems like it's complicated, and maybe it's a process where those things come up, they cause pain, I can deal with that, and then maybe next time it's a little less, but it just seems like it's not as simple as, you know, being more tolerant, or because then the whole guidance system inside of me has to be reoriented somehow, and I'm not sure how to do that.
Does anybody have any thoughts on that or feelings on that? Yeah.
I have something.
Todd?
What comes to my mind is recently in the dark, I'm getting up out of my bed, and even before I got out of my bed, I searched on the side of my bed. My hand went directly to my cup of water, which is on the side of my bed. And I went, how did I know where that was? Mm-hmm. And I got up and I walked to the bathroom and I knew exactly where the door was. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't see.
Mm.
There's words you can put on that, like intuition, or that I was aware of things without me necessarily knowing it. I'm aware of it, and I make decisions by all of it in a way. I think not being reactive, which I think is the basis of. And we're talking about in a lot of our practice, it's not being reactive or noticing reaction and accepting it, identifying, investigating, and that not being it. This practice is unique in that way. It isn't only in a to be, or 2+2, which is all great tools, but it can't function in all aspects of our lives, right?
Hmm.
You are using it all your life anyway, even if you don't recognize it. You know where things are, even in the dark, somehow. So you already trust it, I think. But you need a word on it. You need to put it into the cognitive, and that's where it's...
No, it's more like I just don't hear about that process being discussed.
Mm.
I'm sure it is. It's just, I'm just kind of asking for feedback or reflection on, because, you know, we get to a point, from what I've heard in my own study, like, we get to a point where we talk about how great these qualities are. But, like, I mean, yeah, the process of trying to embody them, that all of us are probably trying to do, is it's messy. And there's a lot of times when I think I'm trusting my intuition, but it's actually more like a conditioned response. But it's very compelling, and it's hard to tell the difference between those two. So yeah, it's true. On the one hand, I trust myself because I get in a car and I don't assume I will die. But on the other hand, I don't trust myself because I see that I'm still deluded. I experience the effects of it. And so, you know, how can I just... What exactly is it that I'm trusting?
Hmm.
You need to have you need to put a word on it.
There's another comment over here. Question.
I think what you mentioned, process, it is a process. But I guess what's more important, where it's coming from. So if it's coming from emptiness, you can tune yourself better over time. Comes from a person, same process, but ultimately fruitless.
Do you have have a way that you determine where it's coming from? I mean, I know you may not be able to express it, but I'm just...
No.
Randy.
For me, I think it's a great, what you're bringing up is a great topic. Because this whole idea about, well, intuitive, emptiness, open mind, is that where we draw our inspiration, our motivation, or is it, or do we get deluded by our habitual mind? I don't think we necessarily have to have a problem with habitual mind. I don't think we need to throw it out. Actually, habitual mind actually is very, there's a lot of intelligence in habitual mind that we just need to have to sort out. For example, we may do something impulsively, but we see ourselves doing it impulsively continuously. So therefore, we start to question the legitimacy of that impulse. And that, so what we're doing is we're seeing that the habitual mind is giving us information about where there might be a problem. So we're not throwing out the habitual mind and saying, okay, I'm not going to be swayed by all my tendencies, my anger, my impulsiveness, my lack of patience, etc. But I'm going to use those habitual tendencies to be able to sharpen my awareness of what may be the more clear path.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you. Yeah, I was reading a bit of Pema Chodron, actually, in this book, When Things Fall Apart. It's a fantastic book. And she discussed that quite a bit, that, you know, we use what's arising on our path. You know, this isn't necessarily a way of rejecting anything, even habitual mind. I really appreciate that point. And you know what, though? Through our conversation, I realized, Leela, that sometimes I sit down and ask myself if I have a hard time wondering if what's arising insistently in a kind of way is an internal nudge of intuition, or if it is an impulse, or if it is just a result of kind of business as usual, you know, from like more of a conditioned or habit. I ask if how do I feel about certain results? And if I'm really attached to a certain result, take that as very interesting. You know, I become curious about where that's arising from. If I'm not that attached to a result, it feels a little more clean. So there's a few checking things that I've kind of like developed, because I keep watching myself even when I'm doing things like that. Like, say I interrupt my girlfriend and say, oh, well, you know, and I think I know what she's going to say, and I just, you know, say what I think she's going to say, and because my mind moves very fast. I know I have a very fast mind. I see it move fast all the time. And then I see it move fast around someone else, especially in discussion, especially in a relationship. And I see it again and again and again and again. And at a certain point, it becomes pretty familiar. And I think Trungpa Rinpoche would talk about, like, our habits sometimes start to feel like an old, stinky, worn-out shoe. They're comfortable, but, you know, we keep them around. Because... I mean, it's like it's stinky. It's like it's time to drop it, or we could drop it, but it's also kind of comfortable. It's what we've known for a while. We've worn it in. It's shaped to our foot. But then sometimes you put on a new shoe, and you're like, oh, my God, the arch support. I didn't even know what I was missing. So you try on something new. You know, I like the discussion. It also reminds me, it's time for lunch, too, but it reminds me of, I used to live in Boulder, Colorado, and I was lost in the woods once, behind the Flatirons on a trail, and it got dark sooner than I thought. It was like maybe just after daylight saving times and ended or something. And I was by myself. I was hiking by myself, and I was I didn't know what to do. I couldn't find the trail. And I'm walking around, and everywhere I went, I kept finding either a drop off of 100 feet or so, or, you know, more trees. But what I could find was this craggy outcropping. So I crawled up to it. At a certain point, I was paralyzed by the fear. And I was like, well, maybe I'll just lay here. I have one cliff bar and a little bit of water. Maybe I'll be okay. until the morning. You know, I can see the town, but I can't get there. I can't get to my car. What am I going to do? And then I got rid. Something took over at a certain point after being paralyzed by fear. Something took over. And it was, do you really know what's around you right now? Or do you just think that every way is blocked? And I just went, well, actually, I don't know. So I grabbed a stick and poked around. I was like, that's not a drop-off. It looked like one, but it's not. And I could walk. And I crawled up, bouldered up, you know, probably something I'd never do unless I was in the state, but the survival mechanism kicked in. This willingness to meet the moment kicked in. And I went up to this craggy outcropping, and I'm worried about mountain lions and bears and all those kinds of things that can get you at night. And I just sat for about, I don't know how long, 20 minutes, 40 minutes, and suddenly, I've never been on that trail before. I knew the way down. I cannot explain it. I've told Eric this story. Eric Remington, a field biologist and man of the wild here at Jokoji. And he's like, yes, we have that sense. We have that knowledge. We have that intuition. It's a part of us as an animal. And he was talking about that last week, I believe, in his talk. You know, and it reminded me of that experience. And I think that it's not unrelated to what you're talking about. Maybe it's not totally related. But sometimes I cannot explain that experience. You know, I don't claim to have any supernatural powers at all or, you know, amazing intuition, but it's just that occurred. I walked right to the trail and straight down my car. But I had to stop and sit and just release everything, including the fear, all the adrenaline, all the concern about survival. It all had to stop. So, speaking of survival and hierarchy of needs, it's my segue into lunch. Thanks, everyone. I really had fun with this discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's all return the cushions.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.